Chapter 65. The Death of Russia. Although the Germans never reached the regions between the Don and the Volga, the Russians there had fought the Communists with great courage and success as early as December 1917. Their first leader, General Kornilov, had been killed in action and was then replaced by General Alexeyev. By September 1918, the command had fallen on the shoulders of General Denikin. From the spring to the summer of 1919, Denikin had recaptured vast territories from the Soviets. He had taken 250,000 prisoners and captured 2,700 machine guns, 700 cannons, and 35 armored trains. By that fall, he was approaching Moscow, the new Soviet capital, from the southwest, and was within a few hours' train ride from its center. During that time, he had liberated more than 30 million people from communist occupation. The British cabinet reported on September 22, 1919, if these 30 million people were given the chance to vote, there is no doubt whatever a crushing majority would vote against Lenin's and Trotsky's return. If the British government was aware of the feeling of the Russian population, one will always wonder why so much pressure was put on Admiral Kolchak to hold elections in the middle of combat. Denikin's success had impressed the British, who thought for a time he was well on his way to liberating the whole of Russia. The British bankers thought they would get in on the ground floor if Denikin won. It seems highly desirable to develop trade and credit in the vast expanses of the liberated regions, suggested the report. The bank's desire became an order for the British government to supply Denikin with substantial quantities of arms and munitions. More important, however, had been the dispatching of several hundred British officers to assist Denikin under the label of advisors, a formula that has been used ever since. The advisors' policy was always a half measure, sending the wrong message to the people it was supposed to help. The Russians had paid the ultimate price for believing Allied troop shuffling and promises would be substantiated with real help. They learned, like all the other allies of the Western democracies, ever since, that they were totally manipulable and expendable. The mediocrities of the democracies never had a clear plan to save the Russians, their vision was limited to feeding grubbly from the public trough or sweating out sordid deals. Heroism, valor, honor, and vision, so courageously displayed by the Russian people against communism, were for the Allied politicians so many meaningless words to be used in political rhetoric. Their petty, putrid minds could never conceive that the Russians had sacrificed their lives for the sake of an ideal. The capitalists felt great affinity for the materialistic Marxists and were always hostile to people who refused the dictatorship of Marxism. Whenever the anti-communist forces seemed on the verge of victory, the capitalists put everything into play to sabotage them. The Poles, the Finns, and the Romanians also experienced betrayals similar to that which Kolchak suffered. Churchill noted. With some coordination, victory would have been assured. Twice this year, 1919, Finland had been ready to occupy Petrograd in concert with General Yudenik, and so were the Estonians, but was discouraged from doing so. Poland wanted to maintain a strong pressure on the Bolshevik front, but again we pressured her to desist. As for the small states, we told them to make their own peace with the communists, because we certainly would not help them. Churchill, World Crisis, page 256. For the Allies, the anti-communists who depended on their support were like so many cards, to be held until a compromise with Lenin could be worked out, at which time they could be ruthlessly discarded. Apart from the vacillation, mediocrity, and double-dealing of the Allies, there was a very important factor that explained Allied preoccupation in curbing or sabotaging anti-communist offensives. It concerned the reverses Jews were experiencing in the areas recaptured from the communists. The violence that was committed against them was regrettable but not unexpected. The Russians had seen with their own eyes that the communist genocide against them was run by Jews and that the Bolshevik Revolution was chiefly the creation of Jews. The first Soviet councils were more than 70% Jewish, the communist leadership was essentially Jewish, and the Supreme Commissar of the Red Army was Leon Bronstein, Trotsky, a Jew whose cruelty made Tamerlane and Attila look like angels of mercy. The genocide of Russians and Ukrainians by the Jewish-led Bolshevik revolutionaries had created strong reactions on the victim's side. The Russians had seen millions upon millions being starved, tortured and massacred by hate-filled Jewish commissars. Their reaction, once they were liberated, did not follow legal due process, but was a spontaneous rage for justice. They had not started the genocide, it was visited on them by non-Russian aliens, they were defending themselves against the worst plague and calamity in their history. In 1918 and 1919, Jewish participation in the communist revolution attacking Germany was also overwhelming, and its victims felt a rage akin to that of the Russians. Russia's popular reaction against Jewish communists evoked strong feelings at the Versailles Conference, where many Allied delegates were Jews: Baruch for the United States, Klotz and Rothschild for France, and Sannino for Italy, among others. Caught up in the thick Jewish atmosphere of the conference, Churchill felt obliged to take General Denikin to task for allowing Jews to be roughed up by the people in the liberated areas. On September 13, 1919, Churchill sent an urgent telegram to his British agents and advisors in Russia: "It is most essential that General Denikin not only do his utmost to prevent the massacre of Jews in the liberated regions, but also issue a proclamation against anti-Semitism." Another telegram on October 9, 1919: "Spare no effort to curb anti-Semitic feelings." Apparently, the British agents were unsuccessful in manipulating the feelings of the victims of communism, which provoked further rage among the Paris Conference delegates. The decision to cut off all aid to Denikin was then made. The delegates had never shown the slightest concern for the millions of people murdered by the communists. Churchill, nevertheless, became alarmed by the sudden aid cutoff. "The news of our retreat and our abandonment of Denikin will lead to his annihilation. The Bolsheviks have triumphed on the other fronts, and Denikin's defeat would give control of the Caspian Sea to the Soviets. The resulting pressure on Persia and Afghanistan will represent a direct and permanent danger." Yet relentless Jewish pressure and Allied cowardice worked for the defeat of the anti-communist Russians and Ukrainians. For a whole year, they would valiantly fight the communists on their own, betrayed by the Allies and sabotaged by the Jews. During the 2 years the British were officially supposed to be helping Denikin, their entire casualty list amounted to one wounded advisor. "It was an illusion," concluded Churchill, "to believe that we had fought for the anti-Bolshevik Russians. They, on the contrary, fought for us." As war minister, Churchill witnessed the fate of those Russians who had fought for the British against the Germans and against the communists. By July, refugees escaping the Red invasion of Crimea were stampeding in the direction of Constantinople. The boats could carry only half of the panicked multitudes. With savage glee, the enemy massacred the last defenders. Smallpox and typhus compounded war and famine. These miserable shipments of sick, dying or dead people kept coming to the Turkish capital, already overcrowded and destitute. A cloud hung over this final phase. After all this, death is a relief. And this was how the victors of the Great War had managed to solve Russian affairs. World Crisis, Volume 4, page 260-261. This was really the end. Sordid interests, electoral politicking, cowardice and betrayal had finally overcome the most important people in Europe. Lenin had won. In Russia, Wilson's 14 points remained as rhetorical as they had everywhere else.